Hey friends, we wanted to take a quick minute and personally invite you to two really special gatherings coming this fall. First, our intentional motherhood retreat in Portland, Oregon, October 15th through the 17th, and then our intentional fatherhood retreat in Austin, Texas, November 12th through the 14th. Honestly, these retreats have become so much more than events for us. They've become spaces where people encounter God, experience healing, honesty, friendship, freedom, and real transformation. We live in a world that is full of information. We have podcasts, books, content, advice, but transformation requires more than information. Sometimes you need space, you need community, you need honesty, you need the presence of God, and you need to get around other people who are fighting for the same things you are. At these events, we've watched marriages soften again. We've watched fathers come out of hiding. We've watched mothers breathe deeply again. We've watched people feel seen, known, challenged, and deeply encouraged. And we would genuinely love for you to join us. You can learn more and grab tickets at intentionalparents.org. And for all things fatherhood, you can visit intentionalfatherhood.org. We hope to see you there. You're listening to the Intentional Parents Podcast, brought to you by Intentional. Intentional is all about spiritual formation in the family. We desire to bring biblical hope and practical help. Enjoy this week's conversation. Welcome back to the Intentional Parents Podcast. Chris McKenna, welcome to the show.
Thank you both. It's an honor to be here. Really.
You've made a trip.
I made a trip.
Yes.
Tell us where you came from this morning. Tell us how you got here, all the different modes of transportation to get here.
I started here.
Yeah. Right?
The land of the hand. Have you interviewed a Michigander who's given you the hand and pointed to where they're from?
I've had people, but not on an interview. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
And we even have the benefit. You can go both if you want UP. You just get it. But from the Grand Rapids area. So I started in my van and then parked it. So funny story. I haven't shared this with you yet, even though we've been hanging out. I got pulled over by an airport police officer this morning.
No, you didn't.
I did.
Where do you get pulled
over? I went through. So even though there was nobody, because it was 5:05 in the morning, there was nobody in front of the airport. And so the little pedestrian crosswalk, which I didn't notice, was a blinking red light, just kind of went right through it because guess what? There were no pedestrians. And he pulled me over for that. Well, now, he let me go.
I was just saying, did you get
it? No, he gave me a warning. Okay. That would have been a really horrible way to start the day. But so I started off with sirens at 5:05.
Just got on really the plane. Wake you up.
Get your nervous system on. Yeah. Got on the plane.
Yep, through Chicago. Then here we are. Got to Portland, got my rental car, and came through the beautiful mountains.
Well, you drove 3 hours once you landed in Portland.
I did.
Need to note this. It was not a small feat to get here.
You know, for the average Midwesterner, we think Oregon's a pretty small state.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No.
It's not even close.
Well, and there's a little twisty-turvy. It takes a little bit of time, but it was beautiful. It was gorgeous.
Yes. I'm glad. Well, that drive that you're referring to from Portland to Bend is beautiful.
It
and
is.
Yes, Bend does have an airport, but if you're trying to get somewhere efficiently, you got a few options to pick from with Bend. And so we can resonate that. But thank you for making the journey. For anyone that doesn't know you, you are a part of and lead something called Protect Young Eyes. We'll talk more about it, but I just want to say we couldn't be more excited about this conversation for lots of reasons. Like most things, like most good things in my life, Elizabeth was the first one to tell me about what work you were doing and what was so funny. I'm sure this is actually very real for many men, but many families. I think there's the amount of women that use social media over men is staggering. And so I think the work that you have obviously lives perfectly on social media because it's the audience you're trying to hit. But so many beautiful things. I want to talk about all that. We have many questions, but I kind of want to just, before we get to that place, you're a human. You have a history. You have life. You have a family. Maybe introduce us to like, what does life look like at home with the people that you're really, you know, on with every single day? Yep. And then I'd love to talk about, I have tons of questions about the work you're doing, but would love to just hear that first.
Yeah, so I've been following the Lord since college, had a transformative experience at a retreat through the Catholic parish that I was attending there at Western Michigan years and years ago. Met my wife, Andrea, there in the business college at Western. We're both on the CPA track, both finance business people. And so we met there and we've been married now for 26 years and have lived in Michigan, both of us, our entire lives, the whole time. And, you know, just slightly different parts, but met at Western and now live in Grand Rapids and have been there the whole time after we got married. But okay. Have four children, ages now 21, 16, 16, and 14. So kind of right in the thick of things, a rising 9th grader, 10th grader, and 11th grader. So we'll have three in high school coming up here, and then our daughter off at college. Wow. So that's what's happening at home. Oh, and two dogs and, you know, a fish that came home with my son last year from his science class. I think he cost a nickel at, you know, or, you know, some cheap science pet that came home. And now a year later, Ricky, it's the goldfish still lives. So
a goldfish that lived that long?
Yes, a whole year. We just passed his 1 year anniversary.
Is he big? Is he big at this point?
It's pretty small.
Okay, I don't know.
For as much as we neglect him, it's a miracle he's still alive.
Duke had, our oldest son had a betta fish. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember hearing like, yeah, don't feed it every day. Cause like they actually do better if you don't feed them all the time. And here I thought, well, I was like, son, you got to feed that thing every day. Right. I think we were unintentional. It was killing it. Anyway, just to say, yeah, I don't know fish culture, but
I'm pretty sure we're doing it wrong. And somehow Ricky has survived.
His name's Ricky too.
His name is Ricky. I don't even know. Anyway.
What was Duke's fish name? I mean, fish names are...
Trying to remember.
Why we even name a fish, that's a whole separate story.
Because it's the lifespan's low. Is your I'm just on in real time pushing the mic out of your face.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. So Chris, we love the work you do, and we were just really thrilled. You have a book coming out. Would you like to just tell everyone when the book's coming out, what the book's entitled, and give us a little snapshot? And we're going to talk about that today, but just right at the top, I'd love people to know that that's happening.
Mm-hmm. So title is 5 Habits of the Tech Ready Family, building on these principles that we've been using with parents in our presentations, using on social media for a long time, mm-hmm. but decided it was time to actually write it down. Yeah. That comes out on June 16th. So depending on when you see or listen to this, you'll be able to find it anywhere that you buy either books or audiobooks. I'm also the guy who read it in a studio a couple of weeks ago. I have this funny text thread that I'm on with my wife and daughter, and I'm obviously in the thread. And I remember my daughter texting Andrea saying, well, where's dad today? And my wife responded back, well, he's in a box talking to himself. And I'm on this thread. And my daughter's response was, I feel like that's like every day. And I'm like, I'm right here. Like, I can see your messages.
I'm so glad. Thank you for sharing this. This happens to me constantly. I am the butt of most jokes at my home, although I do make a lot. It's funny how dads are just so simple to make fun of. But that is a great description. Uh-huh. And I'm also want to say thank you for being the person to read it. Because there's nothing weirder to me at this point, at this day and age, when an author doesn't read their book and you're like, why not? But how was that, just briefly, how was that process? Was it good, exhausting, fun?
It was exhausting. I mean, it was good and it was all the things you just said, but it literally was exhausting. I mean, just to sit and read. And the thing that you find out when you read a book and you have two people that are listening to every single syllable that comes out of your mouth is that you mispronounce a lot of words.
Oh.
And you've maybe been mispronouncing them your whole life. So for example, Elizabeth, I'm going to put you on the spot. Say the word perseverance.
Perseverance.
Okay. So you do it correctly. Say it.
Perseverance.
Okay. So you're also doing it where you actually are enunciating the R in the middle. But little did I know, I've been saying perseverance for like my entire adult life.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people say that.
And you, right? But here I'm getting corrected. No, you have to say it again. Why? I said it right.
But how do you
say perseverance? Like you really, I totally, so that's just good. One simple example of when you have two people that are listening to every letter that comes out of your mouth because it has to be right for the audiobook. You're like, wow, I'm horrible at English. Like,
were there any points while you're reading it where you were like, oh, I wish I'd written that differently or like structured that sentence differently?
You know what's really funny, Elizabeth? So I had, you know, Greta Eskridge, you've talked to her, right? Love her pieces.
Greta.
And she's written, you know, multiple books now. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to her right when I was thinking about putting a book together. And she was great encouragement, kind of counseled me through the process. She said, Chris, I'm going to warn you right now. By the time you're done writing the book, you're going to hate it. And I was like, what do you mean by that? She said, you're going to be so tired of it because you've read it so many times and edited it. And she was right. But what happened is when I read it, I fell back in love with it. Mm. Like it felt right.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened is, and also I'm really glad that my fear going into this because it had already gone to print. you know, when you read something out loud, you sometimes catch things that you didn't catch when you were typing it. In fact, I in the editing process, I had read through the entire book out loud in my office at least once for that reason. But then I had this fear that while reading the audiobook, I would find some dangling participle that Mrs. Soule, my eighth grade teacher, would say, why did you write it that way?
Yeah.
Who still follows me on social media, by the way. We're still, this is excellent. So this is excellent. But I didn't find any of those. And so, no, I did. It sort of, it made me fall back in love with it. It made me get excited again to get it out after I'd been through the 100 or so edits of reading through it again. But it just, it was as if the Lord was saying, yep, this is good. This is right. Great job. And I just hope that it blesses many. So
I have a question. There's something about your title stuck out to me because I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I'm very excited to read it. You said it's called Five Principles for the Tech Ready Family.
Yeah.
What perspective did you write it from? Like the family who, like to me, my mind goes to the family who's like, they're getting to that age where they need to be ready to know how they're going to handle tech. Is that who it's primarily for? Or people who are in the thick of it, they've got teenagers, they're waking up to, oh my gosh, I need to be aware of what's happening. Like, or is it for everybody?
Right. So you've picked up on a couple of really important things to me in that. So Tech Ready recognizes the reality of technology, right? Don't bubble wrap your children and move off the grid. Now, if that's what you want to do, if you want to live a mostly screen-free life as a family, go for it. But I want to communicate that if you choose or can't do that, it's still okay.
Yeah.
That I want us to be ready. And even those families who have said that I want to be as screen-free as possible, one of our principles that I write about is even if you've said no, teach your children as if you've said yes, because we don't control all the digital doorways. They still need to be equipped and prepared.
Yeah.
So the habits, those five habits are meant to live above some of these questions in the weeds. For example, is it for a four-year-old? Is it for a family with teenagers? It's for all of them because habit number one, to model the right behaviors. Mm. Do I want my four-year-old seeing that I'm not connected to my phone all the time? Yes. Do I want my 17-year-old to also see that I'm not stuck to my phone all the time? Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a principle, a habit that lives above some of those detailed questions to try to answer them.
Yeah.
And that's also important because technology is going to change. Mm. There's something related to AI that'll come out next week that we haven't conceived yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I wanted to write something that lived above individual apps, that lived above individual devices, that principles you could apply to whatever comes next.
Yeah.
You'll be able to apply these five habits in a way that I think is helpful.
Yeah.
That's so smart because that is the biggest, as I think of tech, wherever, if you think about putting out an article or writing something about tech, I'm always, that's the question that comes to mind. How do you write something that can keep up with the evolving pace? I've heard, I have some people that I know that have said, well, I'm not going to publish a book so I can get it out now.
Right.
So you're like, okay, well, now you're not going through the publishing process. So that speeds it up. But I mean, that approach of wisdom principles versus, you know, just the generalized moment, I think it's really wise. But, you know, your book's coming out of a place and Protect Young Eye is coming from a place that launched you into this world to even to actually do this work. So I'd love to kind of take a step back and say, for anyone that's not listening, that's like, okay, who is Chris McKenna? What is Protect Young Eyes?
Sure.
Why should I care? Where does this, give me like, where did this come from? Where did Protect Young Eyes come from?
Yeah.
And for anyone that doesn't know, inform anybody of why, and once they know, they're going to be all in. But give us a history of what is Protect Young Eyes and where did it come from?
Yeah, I am not supposed to be doing this, or at least according to my plan. Right. Oh, I'm supposed to be a CFO somewhere.
Yes.
That's what I thought. I'm an accountant.
Yes.
How in the world am I sitting here with the two of you talking about digital safety and families? Like that just was never on my radar as Andrea and I are hanging out in Beta Alpha Psi, the professional accounting fraternity at Western Michigan. Like if you would have said, hey, what's on your bingo card? This was this was not one of those things. So I was exposed to pornography like a lot of Gen X guys my age when I was young. Right, that two-dimensional version that you caught a glimpse of, right?
Yep.
It was still kind of everywhere, even though it wasn't in our pockets. It was still pretty prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a pretty jarring impact on me and my curiosities.
Yeah.
But because that was the 80s, there weren't a lot of ways to carry out those curiosities.
Mm-hmm.
As I say today, the distance between my childhood and harm was a lot wider than it is today. Well, there's a thin space between almost every child in every Christian home,
yeah,
between their childhood and life-changing harm. I think that's what's different about childhood today. In fact, I just responded to a principal that I'm working with at a school who was talking about some incident. Good kids, great school. And my last sentence was, it is so dangerous to be a child today.
Mm.
Like it feels that way. But for me, what that meant in my childhood is I was able to kind of take that experience and sort of kind of tuck it away.
Mm-hmm.
I refer to it as sort of like a landmine. It just sort of sat there.
Yeah.
But then here comes the internet of my college days, right? Sure. In the 90s. Here it is. Now we have what Dr. Al Cooper called the triple A engine, right?
Okay.
Affordability, accessibility, and anonymity.
Mm.
All the time. And that was the detonation for this curiosity that had sort of sat latent for so long. Now I could see anything that I wanted to see anytime.
Hmm.
It was fully accessible. I believed the lie that I wasn't hurting anybody, that nobody would know, yeah, right? That's the part of that triple A engine. And this is all what I tell in the introduction, just to get it right out there, just to put my story right out there in front of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to compulsive use as a young man, as a young married man. Hmm. Until I got to the spot, and there's a post that's going to come out about this soon, where I could point to the chunk of sidewalk where I was standing in the middle of a long run one night, where the Lord convicted me and said, it's time. It's time to come clean. It's time to tell the world. Start with Andrea. Yeah. But it's time to talk, right? Secrets make us sick. And that's just, we all know that, right? And so it was time to talk. And so that's a part. Protect Young Eyes didn't come out of that necessarily, but it was that experience which, you know, preceded me becoming a youth pastor, because I left the business world, 12 years in risk management, awesome job, worked for some of the largest companies around. And then the Lord said, go be a youth pastor, which I said, what?
Oh, wow.
So I left a 12-year career and went into youth ministry. And that was from 2009 to 2016 that I did that. And if you think about that period of time, in terms of the evolution of technology, that's when we decided it was a good idea to put portable internet into the pockets of teenagers.
Yes. Yeah.
Let them carry that AAA engine with them everywhere. And now parents were bad. They just didn't know what they didn't know.
Of course.
Everybody believed the techno-optimism that it was all good.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Right?
Techno-optimism, that's a great phrase.
We all believed it. The marketing that was behind all this, it was going to be good and positive. Having everything, having the BlackBerry, the Palm Pilot, and the Franklin Planner all in your pocket at once was supposed to benefit us, right?
Yeah.
And on the surface, it sounds great. But as I say, you know, I had kids who left things behind at youth group all the time. Their hoodies, their Bibles. But they never left me their new prized possession, which became the iPhone 5.
Ooh.
That's what they started coveting, was this thing that mom and dad were handing down to them. Mm. All the while, I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. That same snake that almost destroyed me, pornography specifically, we just put it in their pockets. Why isn't anybody freaking out about this?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I just started doing some research. I started a closed Facebook group. I started doing some app reviews that we still do today, but that was sort of the genesis of those, was this PDF. I still have a version of it. Okay. Where I was like, hey, parents, have you heard of this new app called Snapchat and this new app called Instagram? And things kind of rolled from there into a Facebook group, some education in my church about pornography, and I launched the website then in 2015. So I can see now, looking back, how this all works together.
Yeah.
Right? I had a professional upbringing in risk management, which caused me to see risk and then put things in place that bring that risk down to a place where it's acceptable. Then I went into ministry, where I learned to love families and to love childhood and to love junior high, which I know makes me really weird, but there's something special about middle school. It's just this extremely spongy, messy, chaotic time of life. And then I watched us put exorbitant risk into the pockets of those kids.
Yeah.
So all that kind of came together to be like, I got to do something.
Mm.
I've got to apply that consultant brain to a problem that needs fixing. And that led to launching the website. Work that we're doing today, that now 2 years in, I'm about 2 years into doing this full time. I ignored, I think, a call into doing this for quite a while.
Okay.
But I went to Covenant Eyes for a little while, the software company, loved what they do for blocking pornography. It's a software I use for a lot of years, but then about 2.5 years ago, it became undeniably clear that I had to go full time into this and run Protect Young Eyes. So if I had to sum it up in a sentence, Protect Young Eyes comes out of a desire to prevent all the 12-year-olds of the parents listening to this from becoming me. That's the reason.
Wow. I gotta sit with that for like a second before, you know, as people are even processing that. What a beautiful mission and heart. And thank you for also just being completely, you know, vulnerable about where it comes from. And most, you know, in most of us, I can say from our story, but our deepest pain is often the place where God wants to redeem and even use in a way that feels uncomfortable maybe to us, or just unexpected, or not what we would assume. And and it's so beautiful because it is a place where he gets the most glory when he redeems those places, the darker places or the places we would think to hide. And your story just highlights again how confession and openness and transparency and vulnerability doesn't actually breed more shame and darkness. It brings healing. It brings life. It brings fruit.
Right. That's
like,
right.
You know, like there's fruit from your life now from honesty, from vulnerability, from transparency. It's not what we would assume, or that the enemy would speak that lie of like, well, death is coming if you just said
that's right
the thing.
Stay quiet. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Wow.
Or if you say it, this will happen. So you better stay quiet.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Wow. Right. I'm thinking of the kids that you just said. Pornography is one problem. Mm-hmm. And we know it's, I mean, arguably the biggest because of what that does to the brain and the future self and all of that and how many layers and fractions it can create. A deeper question I would ask that's similar is, what are the other things that I think if a parent's listening right now and they're like, okay, well, pornography is pretty obvious, Chris, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Give us a landscape. Mm-hmm. For anyone that's anxious, this is going to be your moment to just have a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
What's the landscape of the other dangers that are represented that maybe are obvious, but maybe also not obvious? I'd love to talk about that. We want to let you know about a new offering, a 31-day prayer devotional entitled Sowing a Hidden Seed, Daily Prayers for Your Child's Spiritual Growth. This book was born out of desperation. I didn't know how to lead my kids spiritually, so I started praying honest, dependent, daily prayers. Jeremiah 29:12 says, "Then you will call on me, God says, and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you." If you want to learn more, head to intentionalparents.org. And if you partner with us at $25 a month or more, we'd love to send you a copy as a thank you.
Yeah. So I think, pornography sits under something bigger, which is just content. Just content. There are all kinds of content that live online. Mm-hmm. When you think about the things that we don't want kids to experience at certain ages, there's a whole list of things, not pornography, that we don't want kids to see, including pornography, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Think of all the different adult themes and mature ideas and just interactions and all the things that you see on late night, whatever show or whatever thing. Mm. There's a whole list of things that are totally flying under the radar that I just call too much too soon. In talking to a friend of mine who works with families in counseling, he talks about this idea that young people have a schedule, like a neurological schedule in terms of when you're supposed to learn certain things. Okay. And he talks about this idea of too much too soon. And when you get certain information, what he says, ahead of schedule, it creates chaos for your brain. Mm. And he shared stories of kids who have seen things online, violence, and they come into his office to like try to process it. And they don't even have words to describe. They've just been overwhelmed by something shocking, something mature that they've seen. And so this is a big ramp up to one app, which I would call YouTube. YouTube might be the app that has done more damage to just the innocence of childhood than any other app.
Yes.
Too much, too soon. A guy that a lot of people listening to this maybe will recognize, Officer Gomez. He's over in Idaho. He does a lot of great work like I do.
Yeah.
And I was at a conference with him and he said, "Chris, I was recently in a room with a bunch of eighth graders. I stood in the back of the room and I asked them to anonymously answer a question." And he asked them, "Raise your hand if you've ever seen somebody killed in a YouTube video and a quarter of the room raised their hands. Wow. Now, you could say maybe, I don't know, were they telling the truth or what did they interpret? But I guarantee that more, like any number greater than zero, more than an insignificant number of those eighth graders have seen a human being die in a video. That's what I mean. Too much, yeah. Too soon. Content that you're just not supposed to see. You're not supposed to have to process. You're not supposed to have to file it away in your brain because you don't have a file for it yet.
Yeah.
That's the stuff. I mean, yes, pornography does all of those things to distract and distort and to cause all kinds of neurological, emotional trauma inside of a young person. Nightmares. I've heard people who their kids have been exposed. They found out, they were wondering, why is my kid suddenly having all these horrible nightmares?
Yeah.
And they discovered just kind of through looking at devices and search history that their child had discovered horrible pornography. And that's what they pinned it on, right? So it caused that kind of reaction.
Mm.
So I think that's something that flies totally under the radar. This just sort of, it's kind of like a black mold that you don't know is forming behind the wall from some seam in a deck on the second level that didn't get quite tight. So it's been dripping for 5 years. It's just this little drip, little bit of damage, little bit of darkening of the heart. It's not as egregious as a predator or something. Or, you know, it's just that slow drip. That's the part that I think parents are totally underestimating. TikTok, very similar.
Yeah.
I would invite every single parent who has a kid who uses a video-based app like TikTok, like YouTube, kind of the two big ones, make an account the same age as your child. Just live in it for a few days. Live in it for a few weeks. Just experience the algorithm that they experience. Use it like your son or daughter. Ask some questions that a 14-year-old boy would ask.
Wow.
Like some of the things in TikTok that a 13-year-old girl might like. Yeah. Just experience the weight of a recommendation engine that is constantly changing itself to become the most addictive, compelling, engaging version of itself. Unless you've experienced it, you truly can't appreciate what our young people are seeing.
Wow.
And pornography, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So
yeah.
I want to keep coming back because I'm not.
Oh, it's so.
I'm
prevalent.
Not negating.
No, it's,
the significance of that is just we miss this.
I think why I even asked that question is because that pornography is the most. I think it's the easiest. It's the quickest one because it is so. It's the most popular because it is so.
That's right.
Impactful, accessible, all of that. But to your point, as you're proving even now, there are the things that are maybe like a tier down in the sense of popularity that are causing just as much, if not more damage in some ways. I remember the story, you know, sadly when Charlie Kirk was shot.
Yeah, I was thinking
about that. My son came home and he's like, Dad, did you hear what happened? And now he has an iPhone, but it's locked down. He doesn't have any apps or, you know, YouTube. It is essentially a dumb phone. And so my question to him was like, well, how did you know? You know, and I figured his friends.
Yeah.
But he was at school.
But what he told me was honestly gut-wrenching, honestly the saddest thing he could have told me, which was my friend found the video of him actually being shot and just, and didn't ask. He just literally put it in front. He's like, did you see what happened?
Yeah.
And within.
That happened a lot with that event.
Yeah.
Yes. And so it's just to say like, I and what's so funny is I saw that video too, but not because I was trying to find it. It was literally before, because there was a handful of videos on Instagram that didn't get taken down or whatever quick enough. Yeah. And so when all the news was coming out, it got thrown to my feed and I see this. I'm like, how is this even?
I don't want, yeah.
Yeah. And then it gets taken down quickly, obviously. But even so, then I knew what he had seen.
Yeah.
And I knew I was feeling stuff about what I saw. All to say, like, couldn't agree more with what you're talking about. Honey, what were you going
to
say?
Well, I was going to say, it even goes further than that, to your point with YouTube, is not only had he seen it, but I think it was like the day after we were on a drive to the Portland area. He was picking up his first car that he bought, and we met somebody from the dealership halfway. And so, you know, teenage boys, time in the car is like priceless because that's when you can get him to talk. So we're driving, and we start talking about Charlie Kirk, and then he starts telling me all these opinions he has about him. and how he wasn't actually a good guy. And I'm like racking my brain. I'm like, you didn't even know who this guy was a day ago.
Right.
And so one good parenting moment, instead of just like stomping on it, I started asking him questions. I was sure. trying to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah.
I do not always do that, right? So I just started asking questions like, how did you form that opinion? Like, how do you know that about him? So he starts telling me about these YouTube videos that his friends and him had been watching at school on his friend's phone.
Right.
Showing these clips of debates that Charlie had been a part of.
Of course.
And so I just kept asking him questions. And then at one point I just finally said, hey, bud, do you realize that you don't know anything about this actual man? You've not met him in person. Yeah. You've not sat across a dinner table with him and talked to him. You've not even seen the whole debate. You don't understand his heart for what he's debating for. I don't actually either. I don't know much about him.
Yeah.
But you realize you formed an entire opinion about his character, who he was, everything about what he did, based off of a couple YouTube videos that your friends are showing you and that what other people at school are saying.
Yeah.
And you just, it was like the lights turned on. Yeah. He was like, oh my gosh, you're right.
Yeah.
And then we had this great conversation about all that. But that was just in the, as much as intentional as we are about how we manage technology in our home.
Oh, you can't.
And our kids are not allowed to be on YouTube unless they're sitting next to us and there's been an approved thing that they're, we use it only for learning. Like, we're very intentional about it. And yet, to your point of which I love the work that you do, is you're educating parents what to do in their own home, but also the reality is that they are going to be exposed outside of your home. What do you do with that?
What do you do with that?
Yeah. And I think that's the piece that it is so much easier and takes so much less time as a parent to just put the blinders on and just, it's just YouTube, it's fine. Or it's just kids at school, it's fine. But that's where the conversations with our kids, the involvement with our kids, the doing the work to understand, like what you said, go make an account for your kid's age and actually experience what they are experiencing.
Yeah.
And what we found recently too with our daughter is we used to say yes to Pinterest because she would use it for creative things.
Oh boy.
Pinterest is basically TikTok.
It is.
Like, it's because it's everyone reposting their TikTok videos.
Yeah.
And so here I had, we kind of like realized it when she was maybe like 12. I'm like, I've got this impressionable 12-year-old girl who just wants like beauty tips.
I know.
And can't distinguish the fact that they're all
filtered
and their hair's not real.
It felt sneaky. It felt like, are you joking? Like,
it felt like they tricked you.
Yes.
You're like, wait a minute, this is Pinterest, right?
Not from the early 2000s Pinterest.
No. There was a video just today on Nikki Petrosi is somebody who I follow, scrolling to death. Many probably who maybe will watch this know her. She just did an expose on Pinterest because it's just like all the rest.
It is.
It's still content.
Yep.
It's still an algorithm. It's still based on engagement.
Yeah.
And it's going to follow all the same patterns just over and over again. So.
Yeah.
I want to kind of press into maybe some of the, I'd love for you to just uncover, because right now what you're doing is you're putting language, you're building a world and helping people see reality as it truly is. One of my favorite descriptions of Jesus and how he lived and what a Christian I think really is operating within the reality of the kingdom of heaven, which is reality as it truly is, not with all of the noise that the enemy and especially culture and data and all that stuff tries to distract us into. You're kind of helping take the wool off of our eyes of what we think versus what actually is. So when it comes with that setup, what are other apps? If you were talking to a room full of parents, what would you want them to know? Like about, hey, here's apps that you might think are just fine or games that you think are fine, but are actually incredibly insidious and challenging. Like, give us a education on what we need to be aware of.
Sure. You know, video games seem to be coming up quite a bit in my conversations recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And video games are a pretty complicated topic because the research is actually pretty inconclusive. You can find some research which says that it's pro-social and there are some benefits depending on what kind of kid you are, what kind of home you've grown up in.
Hmm.
But at the same time, we have to remember that every single video game that exists today is radically different than every other video game that we think of as old guys who remember the games that we played.
Yeah.
And I think it first comes down to the plural video game versus video games. Because to us, whenever we hear something like Roblox, we think of it's a video game. Roblox is not a video game. Roblox is a gaming universe full of millions of games populated by over 100 million people every single day. So right away, as a parent, like, we need to shift our frame, our definition of video game into Roblox is essentially a bit of social media for eight-year-olds.
Whoa.
That's a topic that is coming up all the time right now because a lot of kids like to play games.
Of course.
So how do we navigate that? That's really tricky. So
yeah.
Roblox is one that comes up all the time right now. No matter what, even in El Salvador, where I was back in February, this was a hot topic. Mm. Roblox. I did a little experiment while I was down there. Parents who were asking questions about Roblox said, listen, it was like at the parent talks, I'm just going to do a search right now on news about Roblox. And like that day that I was doing the parent presentation, the two top articles were Florida man finds twin girls and kidnaps them because he met them on Roblox. And the second piece of news was the entire country of Egypt outlawed Roblox because of its harms to children. Now, I'm not proposing that we copy Egypt in the way that they manage their people, but I'm saying those should be signals to us as parents that entire countries are deciding that a gaming environment isn't right for their kids. Maybe that should be a signal to us as American parents.
What makes it so dangerous though? Because again, with the lack of knowledge, and I can only imagine the people listening going like, well, Chris, well, why? Help me understand what makes it so dangerous.
Well, it's one of the few games that tries to please so broad of an age span. You've got five-year-olds and 25-year-olds all in the same digital space, right? It's not like, I mean, Snapchat is mostly teens and older. YouTube Kids is mostly young kids. YouTube's a little bit of kind of everything. But like Roblox is this digital space where you have elementary school kids who love it and you have college kids who are building games. It's like a weird space that has this wide age span, which means it's really difficult to manage kids in a way that protects them while also allowing some freedoms for those who are a little bit older. So the game has always suffered from that. Now, the reasons that it's risky today is it's just so many people. Like three times the size of Tokyo is the size every single day of Roblox. So imagine a digital playground that has that many people. You're saying, hey, amazing eight-year-old or 10 or 13-year-old son or daughter of mine, go play this. And that's our frame of it's a game. No, it's 100 million people that you're letting them go and play with. And that's not even to mention, so that's like some of the predatory risks, a little bit of the content, the chat feature. But again, it's the type of environment that it is. It's this extremely stimulating, interacting with a lot of people who you don't know if you don't set it up correctly. It's just, it's all these things I just don't believe that most elementary school kids are ready for. And so I want us to be aware. Again, if you're a parent who's like, Chris, I don't believe you, then go and make an account for an eight-year-old. Go type in the search bar mother or go type in the search bar granny and you tell me the type of horror games that pop up related to those two words in an eight-year-old account that knows that you're 8 years old. And tell me if you think that all the games, as you scroll down the hundreds of games that you just made for an eight-year-old account that Roblox thinks is okay for an eight-year-old, you tell me if every single one of those is okay for an eight-year-old. Wow. Like, those are the questions that we need to be asking, right? Wow. Too much too soon. Now, it's not pornography. It's not that my kid is getting kidnapped. But is their heart ready for some of these digital spaces? Right? That's that Philippians 4:8 test that I want us to put as criteria out for every yes. Before we say yes, does it pass the Philippians 4:8 test? Is it good and excellent and honorable and praiseworthy? Does it pass these attributes for the heart of my kid?
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what Disney princess is on the front of the app. Ask yourself, does it pass that test? And those are some of the second level questions that I think we need to be asking before we say yes to a game. That's just an example.
That's a great. Any others that you would say, hey, just this needs to be on your radar? Obviously, protect young guys and the work you do is going to educate people. But and any of the other like, hey, just be aware of these apps, these games for families, parents.
Well, I mean, I think we've covered, you know, between, you know, YouTube, Pinterest, and the big three when it comes to games are almost always Minecraft, Roblox, and Fortnite. Those are the big three that come up. And I have different opinions about different of them. Again, just don't take any of them for granted. As I say to families, a yes to any one of those three, no matter how involved you are, no matter how good your kid is, no matter what, a yes to Fortnite, Minecraft, or Roblox is always a yes to some level of friction in your family. You are going to create some friction at some level if you say yes to one of those games, just based on how they're built. When you want them to stop, when you want them to put it down, when you want them to do something other than play the game, there's going to be a time where they turn into a rage-filled alter version of themselves eventually.
Yeah.
So if we're going to say yes, just understand that that's going to happen. And then when that happens, remember who to be mad at.
That's a good word.
That is a good word.
Be mad at the software engineer and not your son.
Yeah.
Be mad at the developer and not your daughter. Yeah,
it's doing exactly what
it's
made to do.
It's doing exactly what it was made to do. And guess what? Who said yes? Right? We did. So this isn't your child mad at you. It may feel that way in the moment because of what's going on, but their brain is going through a bit of revolt against that game. So make sure your anger is directed in the right place. Yeah. So just a good reminder for us as parents.
Can you talk for just a minute about Snapchat? Primarily because
with fear and
I've heard so many parents say, we don't do social media,
but we do Snapchat. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and I didn't get
this.
It until, I still don't fully get it, but I get it a little more now. When our son went from being homeschooled to public high school.
Yeah.
And here he comes with his pinwheel phone and no social media of any kind. And the first couple months, there was constant tension with him. And then it really died down, which I'm really grateful for. But because he's like, nobody's asking for my phone number. They're asking for my Snap. And even his teachers were like assigning homework by scanning a QR code. So he's like, not only do I not have Snap, I have to ask my teacher to send it to me another way because I can't scan it as I'm walking out the door. You know,
browser on my phone.
And my texts send green.
I'm a green bubble friend.
This was a true social moment for him.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
He was like feeling it. I will never forget the moment and where I was standing when I was trying to say, like, son, I am so sorry. I can understand the social, you know, outcast feeling that you have. I also really think you have blue energy, right? Like, so even though you don't come across
as good,
please take it. But,
and he does.
But I'll tell you, man, that was a really big barrier. And it was amazing to see how our choice as a family to say, this is our line. Like, this just has to be our line. It was hard to see how much it impacted him even socially in his development. And there was a lot of reasons, like, are we doing the wrong thing? Like, we went through the whole, I think, process that most parents would.
Right.
Like, do we need to rethink this? Is something wrong? Do we need to go a different route? And I think we landed on, no, this is our conviction. But Snapchat,
So I didn't put Snapchat on the list only because I think that one flies above the radar. I think a lot of parents know there's stuff wrong with Snapchat.
Yeah.
I certainly have strong opinions about Snapchat. So if there's one thing I could get out of childhood, and when I say childhood, I refer to anything under 18. Like, that is their one precious childhood. That's not four-year-olds. To me, that's still 14-year-olds.
Yeah.
If there's one thing I could get out of childhood, it'd be pornography, like as an issue. If there's an app that I could get out of young childhood, it would be Roblox. If there's an app that I would get out of middle, like junior high childhood, it would be YouTube. If there's an app that I could erase from the teenage years, it would be Snapchat. I would like to snap and it'd be gone.
Yes, good.
Yeah,
because
tell us why.
To me, there is no app that is more predatory to the neurology of young people than Snapchat, right? What you have to understand about our amazing teenagers and their brains is that they are built on impulsivity, which we love about them. We love their curiosity, their adventurous spirit, their go-get-it. They take risks. We love that about them. We get pretty old and crusty and we don't do that anymore. I wish we did sometimes, but that's what I love about junior high ministry, because you get to see some of that, and then especially into high school. That's because they're at a stage of neurological development where the middle part of their brain, which feels all the feels, that reward sensitivity, social sensitivity, everything that makes them a teenager is ramped up high.
Yes.
the things that they feel in the same situation as us are felt 100 times deeper and more emotionally because their limbic system is on fire. It's a part of the brain that is figuring out how to make sense of chaos and do I freak out, freeze, flight, all of these different decisions that are going on. The teenage years are when you're supposed to take risks and supposed to make mistakes so that you figure out what things belong in the thinking part of my brain versus the part that I'm supposed to respond quickly to. That's all just a part of being a teenager. Here's the thing. Everything about Snapchat is now. Everything about Snapchat is respond now to keep the streak going. Get the messages unread. Do it as fast as possible. In other words, it preys on impulsivity.
Yeah.
So to me, there is no app that preys more on what we love about teenagers and weaponizes the very beauty that God has made in them to be just impulsive and adventurous. It weaponizes that in a way that can do them harm. That's the part that I hate. I hate the fact that you can always see where your friends are on a map and feel left out of stuff and feel like you have to respond instantly. I hate the fact that the streak has taken what is supposed to be a friendship and has turned it into a digital currency that has value based on the number of days that I've sent you a snap. Meaning that just to keep the streak going, I'll take a picture of the ceiling to keep the streak going because now I've checked the box. That's what a relationship is. So it's cheapened and weaponized and all these things. I just think, like I said, it's a predator to their brain for where they are. They want connection. They want relationship. They move fast. That is everything that is wrong with Snapchat. So that one is a firm no for me. None of my kids in high school, right? So, I mean, I have a 16-year-old right now, no Snapchat.
How do you have the conversation with your kids? Like, well, I'm sure you've experienced similar to what we experienced of having to walk our son through all that he felt about our no. How have you had that conversation with your kids? Or are your kids like...
So, you know, with my daughter, it was just kind of on the front end of what I feel is even ramped up pressure. Like, she's a little bit older. So there weren't quite as many kids who had social media in terms of percentage, I didn't feel like, but it was just a, it was just a pretty hard no. Now I have the unbelievable, don't take it for granted benefit that, so I have 16-year-old twins, one who has a smartphone, one who does not for other reasons that we'll talk about. But he actually doesn't want it. He has assessed social media and said, Dad, it looks stressful. I don't want it.
That's so true.
And it is, right? So he and his friends have this unbelievable text thread that they have kept going since they all had, like he had a Gab phone back in middle school. This same group, they have this text thread, which is like this history that I'm sure they'll look at some year and go, oh my gosh, you know, things we said, but that's how he keeps. So he doesn't have any social media and he doesn't, he doesn't want it. And I'm going to ride that train as long as I can. And it's been interesting because my daughter has now gotten Snapchat and, you know, in college, but I've seen her use it so wisely.
So differently. Well, she was prepped.
Well, but I visited her. She made me dinner just recently. It was awesome. And I noticed that Snapchat was like dark. In other words, it, she had like turned off Snapchat for that time. So she has certain times a day where Snapchat is just... notifications are off. It's blocked because she knows that she doesn't want to be distracted. So I love that she's using it wisely. I'm not saying that that's not possible. I'm just saying, man, for as long as possible, that is one that I am drawing a bright line on when it comes to childhood.
I could not agree more. We very much, I mean, and without talking about specifics, we had no doubt that we aligned. I mean, half the stuff that we've decided to do was because
we learned from you.
Anyway. So, so thank you from a distance and glad that you're close. And you've helped us in a beautiful way. But as you're, that's so helpful, the landscape. And I really loved the age. Like if there was one app, you know, go back, listen to that again. If there was one app that you would say, so find out where your kids are in their stage. And if that app's there, I would just also say like, be careful of shame. Like, oh my gosh, I've ruined it. I think you've only done a lot of damage if you just ignore this. If you just say... That doesn't, Chris is making this up. He doesn't, whatever. I think that's the real loss. I think you can always do something about it. You can always create paths of repair, hope, you know, and you don't need to feel, this isn't a shame filled thing or a, you know, even a worry as much as it's like, you got to be educated. I mean, what I hear you saying, what I love about this conversation is giving people awareness, because then you can make a decision. And most people, knowing when you actually have all the information objectively, it's easier to make a good decision. And you're helping us with that.
I want to expand on what you said just a little bit, because please, I think it's necessary.
Please.
Because I just sort of went through what could be interpreted as a pretty shame-filled binary, if you have it, you're a bad parent kind of approach.
Yeah. Good, good.
If you've said yes to Roblox as an elementary, your parent of an elementary schooler, I think I just kind of heard Chris say I'm a bad parent or YouTube or Snapchat. And I want to walk that back in the following way. I want everyone to remember that my professional background was risk management. That's what I did for 12 years. I would go into big companies. I would help them identify business risk and then put controls in place that either prevented risk, never allowed it to happen, detected risk, identified when something slipped through, or had a culture that just deterred risk in the first place. People just didn't do certain things, okay? I want to apply that same mindset to what I just said. If you're a parent who has said yes to Roblox, I want you to see this as a risk-based situation. All I'm trying to communicate is that I believe that saying yes to Roblox in elementary school has said yes to a disproportionately high amount of risk. Here's where the habits then come into play. Habit number one, we model the right behaviors by using our technology in a way around our kids where they go, okay, I see mom and dad using it in a certain way. Habit two, pursuing authentic connection. I'm alongside my child using Roblox with them, shoulder to shoulder, playing it, having conversations about it. What I'm trying to say is, if we've said yes to certain risky apps, the antidote to that isn't always just rip it out of their lives because Chris has made me feel horrible because of it. It's let's jump in and offset the risk that Chris is communicating so that my kid doesn't fall into harm. A yes to Snapchat doesn't mean you're a bad parent. I'm just saying, and there's a whole section about this, if you've said yes to Snapchat, then it's time to be ridiculous as a parent. The way you mitigate Snapchat's risk is by being ridiculously involved, ridiculously frequent conversations, ridiculously direct conversations to bring the risk down to a spot where it's acceptable. Meaning, if you've got a son who has a brain that maybe makes impulsive decisions and he has Snapchat, which is a bit of a combustible combination, then you take that amazing son, you put your hand on the back of his head in a moment of when you think he's kind of listening, you'd be like, hey, buddy, listen, let's just agree right now. You've got Snapchat, but let's agree to something right now. You are never going to take a picture of your penis and send it to another human being.
Yes.
But that's what I mean by you mitigate the risk of an app like that by saying ridiculously direct and honest things as often as possible. Yeah. Get his attention.
Yeah.
And just be real honest. Like, okay, bud, joking, not joking, but seriously.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've said yes to this app and I probably said yes too soon, and it's my fault for not preparing you for some of the things and the pressures that you've probably experienced by having it. It's my job as a dad to say some things that are going to be a little awkward, but I've got to make sure that you're listening because this is the kind of stuff that changes lives, right? So if we've said yes too soon to the technical, we offset that with ridiculous relational to bring that risk down to a spot. That's what I mean
by
you know, some of those habits, some of those things we do as parents that don't intend, I don't want you to feel, so I wanted to kind of walk back.
I'm so glad you did.
That shame
part of it, because it'd be easy to walk away from what I said at first and go, I'm doing it all wrong, you know, and I didn't want that at all.
That's not
what we're all about.
And obviously, you know, I know that that's not even close to your heart, but what that opened up was even the more beautiful reason of why you need the book. Because even that framework of just like, it's actually not that hard to do. It's uncomfortable, yes. It's not, most people want to do the right thing. It is the lacking the model or the instruction that is the usual biggest barrier.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
And this is why I'm so excited about the book, because like you're going to be giving people that framework. Well, okay, if that's the case, than this. And if you can avoid that, or if you don't want to have the ridiculous conversations, then maybe that's not an app for you. You know, it's like having choices, having the ability.
Some options. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And that's what I love about even your work, your heart, and nothing comes across as shame filled mm-hmm. as much as it's like instructive. And I appreciate the background, because that does inform, like, man, you're looking at things in ways that you were trained to literally understand and look at, which is one of the reasons I think the work that you're doing is so helpful and so good, is because you are actually able to analytically look at this. And now I want to, with all that, because we could go in so many different places, but one of the things I wanted to highlight is, you know, you mentioned you have twin sons, and, you know, we're a part of the special needs community. We have so many beautiful conversations. Our life has been so changed in very obvious ways that weren't what we expected.
Right.
Ways that we're so grateful for. We wouldn't change it, but it's very different. And the dynamic is way more, it's way less straightforward. So many, and especially, and this is where I'm just so excited to even hear what you have to say, especially around screens, because for our sweet birdie, a screen would be her demise.
Yeah.
You know, giving her an iPad would in many ways cause her to go into a world where we might never even get her back, you know? And so how do we give us a highlight of your story in your particular situation, but then also how you've tried to navigate this unique setup in your own home with your own kids around technology and all these things we're talking about today.
Yeah. Far from perfectly. I'll just put that out in front. So twin boys who are 16 and then 14-year-old son. So my 14-year-old will be in ninth grade coming up here. And then Grant and his fraternal twin. Grant was born with Down syndrome. Mm. His fraternal twin was not. We had no idea until after they were born.
Really?
We had no idea. Wow. In utero, we did not know. It wasn't until after a bit of an emergency C-section that the neonatologist came out to us and said, well, baby A and baby B, right, all these kind of things. He said, well, you're pretty sure that baby B has Down syndrome. We're 90% sure. And that was the first we even knew. So 5 minutes after a C-section, which as a husband watching is a bit of a wild experience. I can only imagine what it's like. But then we're given that news. And now 16 years later, are trying to navigate day to day. And the technology part of it is fascinating, because there is nothing in technology that respects any of Grant's vulnerabilities, to your point. Right?
Yes. Yes.
He has no stopping cues. He has the curiosities of a 16-year-old, but the executive function of about a kindergartner, maybe a first grader, in terms of being able to stop and, you know, not go down certain paths. And so, yeah, we have to be really, really careful. And on one hand, it's hard. On the other hand, it's easy. What I mean by this is we just have to remember. Like, if I had an actual 7-year-old in the house, I would do technology a certain way. I just have to constantly remind myself that I still have a 7-year-old in the house and not take for granted the size of his body dictating the digital rules that we make in our home. Mm. And it kind of comes down to one principle. Everything connected to the internet has to do no harm to the most vulnerable person in the house.
That's great.
Not rule. The youngest, but the most vulnerable, because in our homes, that, like for me, the youngest is not the most vulnerable. It's my son with Down syndrome. And so that's a mindset that we share with grandparents all of the time, because one of the tough doorways that kids run into pornography and all kinds of egregious content is at grandma and grandpa's house, because grandma and grandpa don't worry about filters. They may not even know that they have Wi-Fi. Yeah. It's a router that was installed by an ISP. It's under a couch somewhere. They just know that it's there. Grandma's house is actually one of the 6 worst places for a kid to be online. So when I do these presentations to parents and go through the list of buses and bathrooms and basements and bedrooms and sleepovers in grandma and grandpa's house, they all kind of go, what? Grandma and grandpa's house? I need every grandma and grandpa to ask themselves, who are the most vulnerable humans that visit your home? Mm. It's typically your grandkids.
Yeah.
Is your phone, grandma and grandpa, or in this case, is my phone, right? When I think about my own device.
Yes. Yeah.
Here, I'm a 50-year-old man. I shouldn't need, but yes, would my phone do no harm to Grant.
Yes.
Who somehow, some way could get his hand on it. Yeah. Every parent who has children in the home needs to ask themselves that question. And this comes up too when parents ask me about, well, my kids, let's say you have an older son or daughter who moves back in the house. Maybe they come home for summer. Mm-hmm. I get asked that question all the time. What should the rule be for my 20-year-old who's living in the basement?
Yeah.
And my first question is always the same. Are there younger siblings in the house? If the answer is yes, then I don't care how mature or what rules they think do and don't apply to them. Their device must do no harm to the younger brothers and sisters in the home. That's just part of the responsibility of being an older, I'm an oldest, but being an older brother or sister, but that's the same rule. It's not just you. I'm not just picking on you. My device is the same. It does no harm to that 8-year-old son, brother of yours. I don't care if you're 20. So that's just a mindset that we've tried to adopt across everything that connects to the internet. Mm-hmm. The smart TV, which has an annoying passcode on it. Yeah. Why? Because I don't want Grant to click and watch iCarly all day long, which he would if I let him. Or the Thundermans, one of the two. You know,
well, we put our TV on a cart. They have these fashionable carts now, and we literally, because we were like,
we had to remove the visual cue. For our daughter who would
fascinating.
Be so obsessively not, asked to watch.
So, in the studio right now, there's a massive TV that we use for interviews, but there's a cart, but there's like even smaller ones for smaller TVs. And we just decided like we're going to primarily leave it in the coat closet, but when we want to watch something, we just roll it out and it's super easy for them to roll out and then, you know, and still passcodes or whatever. But it's so much extra work when it's like, in the living room, you have to get it out. That one, even lack of visual cue and physical
that's
movement.
That's really smart. Yeah,
was
I
just
love
something
that.
That has been so helpful. But it's just such low-hanging fruit when you think about it because you can still watch TV when you want, but it just doesn't have to live out. But I'm laughing at the grandparent comment because I remember, and Bill and Diane, who are on this podcast often, I remember talking to them and like, hey guys, so our kids are at your house all the time. And it was so funny because I didn't know about your frame, that's six, and I wanted, that's great. But it was primarily because I had this thought because I remember being a kid of like, I don't think have any clue that they have restriction options on their phone. And I guarantee because they don't know, they don't have any on. And I also guarantee that they're not trying to find anything. They're trying to watch the evening news and they're trying to watch basketball. That's what they have internet right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, truly in the most sincere, beautiful way, just in unequivocally unaware, just like, whoa.
Right, totally.
And I remember I came to them and was like, here's the deal. I don't think this is a thing. And I know our kids aren't trying to find anything. They were younger, but I was like, I would love if they're here all the time. Can we please? And what was so funny is it wasn't even funny. It was so great. They immediately were like, absolutely. Of course.
Yeah.
The problem has been that they can't remember their own passcodes for stuff, even if they're written down. And so it got to a spot where they're like calling me on a trip somewhere. I'm like, I have to download this app to open my garage. And I just don't even know what the code is. And I was like, you made the code. Like, you're asking me.
I've gone the exact opposite direction.
Like, I'll keep all of your passcodes, I guess, on my phone so we can figure this out. But I think that is such a great thing. Just one more question to make it even hyper clear for the person that's listening to this. Like, okay, what does it mean to have the phone safe for the most vulnerable? Describe what that means.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's at a couple of layers. They shouldn't be able to get into it.
So passcodes.
And then getting back to that content conversation, we've got to make sure that they can't get to content that could harm them.
Okay.
Right. So does that mean we probably need to audit some of the apps in the doorways that are on our own phone from time to time because we just download a bunch of stuff and just keep it on there?
Absolutely.
Yeah, probably.
Absolutely.
If your child in any way uses your phone at any time, then do an audit from time to time and just delete some stuff.
Yes.
So just at those two levels, at that passcode level and then at that filter or content level, make sure they couldn't get to something because it's more the curiosity, that weaponized curiosity. The example I sometimes use is, I mean, if your kid loves dinosaurs, the difference between T-Rex and T-Sex is like one letter. And you wouldn't want that curiosity to be weaponized in a Google search or even in YouTube or anything where they just type in a wrong word and not intend to see something. It's that curiosity that can be used against them. So wow. that's on our own devices.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
And we have passcodes on our devices as well. But yeah,
do it real simple.
Keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to just, this is important, and it's not a pivot, it's a continuation. AI is such a thing. I would love to hear, what are you most concerned about as you look at this landscape about AI? Is it what kids might be able to see or how they learn, relationships? Like, what is your felt deepest concern as you see it, as you're in this body of work?
Yeah, you know, we have the benefit now of so much analysis and information that's coming out in the timing of when we're even having this conversation. We're right. sitting just days after when Pope Leo put out a 40,000-page encyclical just related to AI. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's exactly what the church, the capital C church, needs to kick itself in the tail, I think, to engage in this conversation in a way that we haven't. But some of the problems that I'm really concerned with, and you know, Pope Leo summarizes some of this, is number one, it allows us to do things quickly that should take time.
Hmm.
Most of the beautiful things in life, learning, relationships, they involve friction. They involve process. They involve struggle. They involve mistakes. Little trial, little error, little this, little of that. That's what we thrive on, is learning from those things. I always kind of go back to the B movie. You've seen the B movie, right?
Yeah.
To me, that's a bit of an
Seinfeld,
that's
right?
a bit of an yeah. illustration as to kind of what we're up against here. Where when they got all the honey, what do? They just all sat around because they no longer had to work, right? They could just, and they didn't really know what to do with all this freedom, no longer having to work. There's no friction in being a bee anymore. I have to go out and get pollen. I have to do anything, right?
Yeah.
So I've thought a lot about that movie in terms of us as humans, as created beings, that, you know, there's something about life. There's something about us thriving that involves struggle, that involves working through things. And we've eliminated all of that. Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath, who does a lot related to ed tech in the classroom, he talks about AI in this way, as this really great quote. He says, AI was a solution we didn't ask for, solving things that didn't need to be solved.
Ooh, that's...
Isn't that good?
It's so true.
It's so true, right?
Yes.
So when it comes to maybe health and information or decoding scrolls and things that we never could with just our human capabilities, beautiful. Yeah. But when it comes to being able to cheat and using it as therapy and going to it for inspiration and writing prayers for my sermon, I mean, is this the way in which we're supposed to be using this technology? Is that inspiration? Is that struggle? Is that prayer and pondering? Or is that just the easy, friction-free way out, right? So I just want us to ask these really critical questions. You know, part of childhood is experiencing childhood. It's falling out of trees and skinning your knees and stubbing your toes and not always getting picked and not always getting great grades and figuring out how to learn things and struggle and working through life. And AI is taking all of that away. And our kids need to feel that to become a resilient version of us as adults that interact in a world that's tough, interact with people who aren't always nice, on a team of people that we don't always agree with. Yeah. You don't figure that out by talking to an AI companion. You don't figure that out by only having digital relationships. You figure that out in the real, incarnate, in real life version of life. This is what we're made for.
Well, I got to ask though, with AI, because this is, I'm just thinking this with our family, with kids, with high schoolers, like, where is the, do you allow ChatGPT? Like, where, or AI, like, do you allow that? Where's the line of like, hey, this is something that you can use as a tool. Do you let it on their phone? Like, I'd love to know your thoughts on that.
Never on the phone. No. Okay. To me, it's an experimental technology, purely experimental. We rolled out AI different than we roll out everything else. Like, imagine for a minute, especially when it comes to childhood, imagine for a minute that we had an experimental drug that helped some kids get over a cold faster. Some of them. But it caused 14 of them to commit suicide. But we said, let's put it on every Chromebook that's in school and let them experience this drug in some way. Let's let them download it from the app store and get the drug administered in that way. Like, we don't roll out anything else as it pertains to children in the same way that we unleashed artificial intelligence on childhood. And so it is purely experimental. No child should be using AI unless an adult is like lockstep shoulder to shoulder with them. It's just that untrustworthy. So that's my stance. Until, you know, the burden of proof goes the other way. I think we should be waiting for evidence that it's helpful instead of waiting for evidence that it's hurting them before we say no. Like, we've got it all backwards. That was something Jonathan Haidt said at the very outset of The Anxious Generation with social media. It's like the burden of proof is all wrong here. Right? In a criminal case, you want beyond a reasonable doubt because putting innocent people in prison is a bad idea. But in a civil case, if I just want to say, hey, you did something wrong to my yard with your dog, whatever, if the judge thinks you probably did it, guilty, pay up. That's the burden of proof we should be using when it comes to children and technology. There's a bit of smoke. Okay, let's wait. Childhood's doing fine. Let's wait for evidence that proves beyond a reasonable doubt that it's helpful instead of waiting for beyond a reasonable doubt that it's hurting them for us to say no. We've got it all backwards and we're committing the same sin all over again with AI because it's easy and it feels good.
This is so good to talk because like, real talk. We let our son have ChatGPT because I was thinking, well, this could be helpful for certain things with school and everything and all that. And I was like, that's changing as soon as we get home. But as per usual, we're going to talk about it. We'll have a great conversation and he'll be like, what? And I'll be like, it was Chris's fault. I don't know.
I think that's a statement that gets made in a lot of houses. Chris. He came to town and ruined me.
No, but is you're blessing so many people. But you said something about Anxious Generation. What an important book. What an important book. Where, in your opinion, because you find yourself, you're a person of faith, you follow Jesus. I'm imagining you go to a church. You're a part of the
We do.
Community. But you're also in this world where you see technology and you're kind of straddling these different worlds where there's a lot of people that aren't in faith or are very different faiths that are growing, learning, and being helped by the work you do. But from the Christian perspective, what, in your opinion, should the church's role be in this? Or what has the church been failing to do? Or how can we help in this?
Wow. Yeah.
And we love the church. We're all about it. I was a pastor for many years. I'm not looking for dirt on the church as much as like, how can we, that's listening to
this. It's our responsibility.
How can we light that fire?
We have a lot of church leaders who listen because our background, my parents' background is church ministry. We're all for the church. So you also have the mic right now to talk to a lot of leaders who need to hear your perspective.
Well, I mean, at least in the civil just society that I want to live in, multiple layers should be working toward the safety and protection of children, right? First and foremost, homes. Homes are the primary disciplers. We've got to own that, which is the primary work of Protect Young Eyes. Not exclusively, but a lot of it. Then we have schools. Schools have a responsibility. I think we call digital discipleship, not digital citizenship, but an eye on eternity with our digital choices. We have a whole curriculum around that. We believe that it is as important as any other subject that is taught today in terms of what kids will be using daily in their relationships, in their decisions, in their jobs. The way in which they use technology needs to be elevated with a lot of other subjects. So you have home, you have schools, then you have places of worship. You have governments with laws and regulations, then you have companies. Those are the five layers that I often talk about that I explain in the last chapter of the book. The church has a significant and a role that I think they've mostly let go of and have not done enough to be forceful and direct and loving about this issue. Like, one sermon a month should be begging families to keep this darkness out of the lives of their kids. Like, begging them. There is nothing that is robbing children of childhood like that screen. I mean, what else do families need to hear? When you look at the different sermon topics, like, what else is going to be more helpful to the flock? It is begging parents to keep as much of this technology out of their lives as possible. And I just don't think the church has taken this issue seriously.
I'm thinking, what better place for collective action to begin?
Exactly.
If you have, you know, there's a group of people that you are doing life with, that you're going every week, and that's, you know, right, we are all on the same page here. We might that's go right out to our neighborhoods or our schools, and there might be less families like us. But like, what a place for that collective action, like Jonathan Haidt talks about. The solution is
it's
us
right there.
Is let's just finding together one or two. But can that's you imagine right whole church communities?
Whole church communities.
And we're doing this together. You're not the only one, son.
And there are some. Yeah. I want to give credit where credit's due. Like yes, Darren Whitehead and the
oh,
detox.
Yeah,
they,
yeah,
right.
We've
I mean, great him, stuff, yeah, right? There are some. I don't want to throw it all out, but oh, yeah, imagine if every pastor, I think I heard
that
him say recently, you're probably saying to yourselves, boy, when's he going to quit talking about this? And like paraphrasing, yeah, I'm going to quit talking about it when it quits being a problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right? Or something along those lines. Yeah. And yes, I want every pulpit and stage to have that same yeah mindset. I was jokingly saying with you yeah before this interview, and Jonathan won't mind that I say this, but I feel like The Anxious Generation was the church's book to write.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
That we knew that. Like we knew those things deep yeah down in our hearts. We didn't have all the research, you know, we didn't have the PhD necessarily, but we knew there was something wrong
yes
with dropping 100 million people and 100 million choices into the pockets yes of amazing sixth, seventh, and eighth graders.
Yes.
And we've, for the most part, been silent about it.
Mm.
And so it's our time to step up. We need to activate all the different audiences. Yeah. We need to look at a church the same way that I look at a school. There's all these different places where we need to insert this idea of digital discipleship, yeah, forming children in this way. Your new member class should be talking about this. The way in which you onboard people into the church should be talking about this. Mm-hmm. Certain ceremonies should include elements of this, whether your dedication or baptism or confirmation or the change from kindergarten to first grade or from fifth grade to sixth grade or from eighth grade to ninth grade or for yeah every one of these spots where families, where you have an opportunity as a church because you already have some process, some ceremony. I'm not trying to add more to a plate that's already full. Mm. I remember people that used to come to me when I was in ministry with some great idea. And I'm like, yeah, you really think I got time for that? What I'm asking is for the things that already exist, the machines that are already working, remind them of this that matters too.
Mm-hmm.
This is critical. And I want people who come to the church to know right away that this is an important part of what it means to form children in,
yes,
in the way they use technology.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure that, you know, every church is going to have to apply that a little bit differently, yeah, but at just yeah that, you know, at a principal level, we just have got to be saying these things more often.
I find it funny because people, certain people will, I've heard this come up a couple different times, not many, but enough to be like, well, this is not just one person.
Yeah.
Of the fact that because of Jonathan Haidt's religious position or lack thereof, it's like, well, I don't know if I can recommend this to my church. I'm like his answers,
his answers
are
so
literally
Christian,
so biblical, it's silly, yeah, you know. But just to say, like,
that there's a divinity axis yeah actually in, I mean, come
yeah
on, you
no,
recognize,
yeah, yeah. I get it. I just, you know,
yeah,
but, you know, to kind of just close our time, I would love, well, there's a few things. I actually, we could just keep talking for a long time, but maybe just to say, there's a couple things that I do want to mention. I want us to end with some hope. But you kind of also mentioned a story before we started recording, which was interesting to me about, it was about a mom in Glances. Like you were talking about this. Why I'm asking you like to even maybe share a little bit of this is because that story to me is so real. Like that's a very real moment. And I think it just gives perspective a little bit. I don't know if you're comfortable sharing that, but if you are, I'd love to kind
sure
of hear that. But then
sure
also maybe even just like the, where's the hope in this? Because I feel hope for sure. But for anyone listening to this, and I'm thinking of the person who's just incredibly negative and probably doesn't want to hear this anyway. Thinking of like help those who might be feeling overwhelmed by this, feeling the hope and where this could lead if we
yeah
actually do get some of this.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, I want to sort of just put out in front, John chapter 1, this beautiful balance that John uses to describe Jesus as grace and truth.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That both are necessary. There's a tension there. Finding that balance is right. I hope that people that interact with Protect Young Eyes feel a bit of a balance, mm-hmm. right? There's a truth version of digital safety and there's a grace version of digital safety, but I believe that both are yeah. absolutely necessary. Well said, well said. I think that story maybe points to a little bit mm-hmm. of that we were talking about. And it's a story that I related on another podcast. I was having a conversation. Someone had shared this with me where there was a mom who had... I'm going to admit, I can't remember if it was a mom or dad. I'm going to say a mom who had gone to a park, and this was her routine with her daughter, was she was going to a park and she was sitting on the bench like a lot of us do, and kid would go off and play and swing and do all the kinds of things that a kid does at a park. Great. On one hand, you're going, they're outside. This is great. They're not on a screen, on an iPad, watching YouTube. That's great. Awesome. Mom's routine was, while daughter was playing, was just to scroll on her phone. Like all of us do, right? Mm-hmm. You get that moment just to kind of decompress, go through the news, go through social media, whatever it is. That went on for a while. At one point, mom decided, you know what? I'm not going to take my phone out. She had been convicted in some way that she had been on her phone too much. Like, I'm not going to take my phone out. And went to the park and just kept her phone away and just watched her daughter. And what she noticed is while her daughter would play, from time to time, her daughter would just look and see if mom was looking. Little glances. And it struck mom. She wondered to herself, in the weeks, however long they've been going to the park, how many glances had I missed during all that time? Now, there's two very different visceral reactions that I get whenever I share this story. The one is, wow, how mindful that she realized this. What a great conviction. I'm sure that she probably appreciates getting those beautiful glances from her daughter. Moving in that kind of grace, I'm okay. The other side of this is, how dare you condemn a mom who needs a little bit of a break? Tell me you're a dad who's never taken care of kids without telling me you're a dad who's never taken care of kids kind of approach. That is a comment I actually got on that post. And I want us to kind of maybe land somewhere in the middle there. Yes. There is a beautiful mindfulness. I'm not saying you can't look at your phone.
Sure.
I'm just saying that there's always an opportunity cost of your daughter constantly seeing a parent on a phone. Let's just recognize that as a reality. Mm-hmm. It's not that she can never see us on her phone, but if she constantly does, is there a bit of a cost that goes with that? And I think the answer is yes. Not shame. That's just being mindful and maybe adjusting some of our digital choices as a result. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the little, what I call kind of micro moves that we can make as parents. Yeah. We don't need to bubble wrap. We don't need to totally get rid of our phone for a, 40-day period or anything. Just, I think there are little things that we can do, little shifts that can show our kids the beauty of connection, that authentic human connection that I talk about in Habit 2. I want us just to look for those little moments. It doesn't have to be life-changing. Mm. So it's just kind of one example.
Yes. It's a great example.
And, just to build on that, I think that's, I wrote the book with the idea that these are very achievable things.
Yeah.
That you don't need to be a tech expert. You don't need to be a perfect parent. These are just things I want you to try, right? So we model the right behaviors. We can do this. We can make little adjustments to our own phone use. Mm. We pursue authentic connection. We have all the awkward conversations. We reach out to them relationally and do whatever we can to say things so they know that they can land safely and softly with us. Mm. We encourage work and play. We keep them active so they know the importance of some of that friction and some of that being out in the world. We then get into habit 4, which is we delay addictive, not all, but addictive technologies. Mm. Again, we're not a become Amish, yes. No tech. It's yes. Just delay is the way is a slow tech strategy. Mm. And you're motivated to make some of those delay decisions, like both of you, when you understand what's happening in their mind.
Yeah.
When you understand what's happening in their heart, which is why that chapter spends so much time on the neurology and the development and the limbic system and all the things I talked about before with Snapchat. And then the last chapter gets into the nitty gritty, the routers and things, the conversations you were having jokingly with your parents about, filters and passcodes. And that's where we wrap them in layers of protection. We diligently prevent harm. So it's a relational first, technical second kind of approach with scripture kind of layered in throughout.
Mm.
Because we start with the things that we can do. We know every parent watching, listening to this, I want them to know that you are uniquely anointed to lead your children in technology.
Good job. Yeah. Yes.
Amen. You are.
Yes.
You don't need to understand how it all works. Relationally, God has designed you and created you to lead your children in this way. Mm-hmm. And that's why we start with those relational aspects of modeling and pursuit before we get into the stuff that stresses us out, to build some confidence so we can guide them with grace and grit. So that's why I've oriented them the way that we have. That's why we put them in the order that they're in, because I think these are things that every parent listening to this can do.
Mm.
I love that. I love that approach. I know we probably have to wrap up so we can do this rapid fire.
Okay.
But I'm thinking of the conversations I have on repeat all the time with parents who are in the beginning stages or are coming close to navigating phones specifically. Thinking of specifically phones. And most of them are scared. The ones I'm thinking of, they're really intentional parents.
Yeah.
They want to do it well.
Yeah.
I think the enemy would like us to either live in total lack of awareness. Let's just be blind to what's happening and let's just say yes to it and kind of let the kids run it. Or the opposite. Live in complete fear, clamp everything down so much just because we're so scared about what could happen.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think wisdom is somewhere in there. And like, I think the Holy Spirit wants us to be able to navigate it with wisdom, with an absence of fear, or being able to at least acknowledge our fear.
That's right.
And bring it to Jesus. But I talk to so many parents who are like, I'm like just starting to think about leaving my son or daughter home alone. Yeah, and I'm thinking about what am I going to do about that? Or at what age do you give a phone? At what age do you give a smartphone? Could you, and I know that your answer to this question in a year, 5 years, 10 years might be different.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, with the information you have, with having walked through it and are walking through it with your kids, what would you say is a wise path? I don't even want to say the best path. That's my personality, Ben. What's the right way to do everything? What do you feel like is a wise path from the kid who's going to start staying home alone all the way to the point that they have an iPhone, maybe even with less restrictions because your daughter's going to college or recommended path be?
Yeah. So I'll say something that I've said before, but just to keep it out in front of us again, this is looking at risk and trying to do certain specific things that bring it down to a spot. We can't eliminate all of it, right? So that's, I think what we want as parents is to make sure that nothing bad ever happens to them, right? That's a good motivation. Nobody wants harm.
Yeah.
You know, so, but at the same time, that's really not my goal. I mean, I can try, but that's not a promise that I can make to every parent. Okay. Yeah. So something that we have said is I want to look for opportunities to let them fail small so that I can see how to best protect them. Right. So if you have a young child, I let them use some technology with me and I'm observing and I'm seeing the sorts of questions and the things they're clicking on and what are the things that they enjoy watching. And I use that as information so that I know what their curiosities are, what some of their vulnerabilities might be. Right.
Yeah.
And then I can use that in making decisions about, okay, when I leave, based on what I know about them and the devices that we have in the house, what do I need to have locked down versus what can I have open. Now, for young kids, we leave them home alone. I don't want anything really connected to the internet, which means we've got to do some things that are a little countercultural right now. It could be the tin can phone, which is really popular
now. Cute.
Yeah. It could be
it's on back order. I keep trying to buy it. It's on back order.
Or you could go old school. I've got an old VTech. You can get a VTech charge dial phone is voice over IP through our router that you can use as a dial phone. Now, what's really funny about that is you get used to certain things backwards. Like on that phone, you hit on and you dial the number and it just dials because you don't have to hit send or anything like you do on it.
So
you have to almost kind of retrain yourself. That has nothing to do with your question you asked me. It was this funny realization of that's how phones used to work.
Yes.
Is you just dialed it and it rang.
Uh-huh.
But that was a decision that we made, was we were going to have an actual phone for when we did leave them alone because I wanted to leave them home alone.
Yeah.
I wanted to let them experience some time without us.
Yeah.
Because later when it comes to assessing readiness for something like social media, one of the questions that we used to ask at the very beginning of Protect Young Eyes is, can you leave your child home alone for 2 hours without checking in with them? If the answer to that question is no, then they're not ready for social media,
yeah. Yeah.
where they're going to have all kinds
Good
of interactions
point.
That
yeah.
you
yeah.
can't control. So I think it's just, you know, it's a matter of knowing your kid. It's a matter of understanding the digital risks, which we try to break down on our website with the devices and the apps. You put those two things together and just ask, okay, based on what I know and what I know could go wrong, how am I mitigating risk to a spot where whatever situation they're in, whether it's at home alone, whether it's hanging out with their friends, which means now to bring the risk down, I've got to have that awkward conversation with the parent of the friend of my kid, because that's what it takes to bring risk
yes.
down.
Yes.
So it's just kind of constantly asking those two questions. Yes. What do I know about my kid? What do I know about the digital risk in this situation? And yeah. taking action as a result
yeah.
and not, you know, buying the lie, especially that one, I think when it comes to our kids hanging out with other kids, I hear all the time from parents, they just don't want to talk to the other family. We're afraid to do that.
Yeah. yeah. Mm.
But honestly, that's just what it takes oh. in the digital age.
Yes.
We've lost friendships over this.
If you're yes. going to mitigate risk to a spot where your kid isn't falling into harm that leads to therapy and some kind of trauma, this is just what it takes. Now, yeah. there have been stories that I've heard of friendships that have been ruptured as a result of this, but I've more often heard is that was actually a pretty unfounded fear. And that by being the parent who asks some curious questions yeah. about mm-hmm. what their digital rules are, using words from John Acuff, another awesome author, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You give the gift of going second. You give that family the one of not being the, oh, that's what you believe. Oh, and they jump right
yeah.
on board. I've
yeah.
seen that happen often yeah. too, which is why there's a whole section in the book on yes. what kinds of yes. non-judgmental questions to ask
yes.
in that situation. So a long-winded answer to your question, because I'm trying to encapsulate,
yeah, no, it's good.
Again, more at that principle level,
yeah.
whether they're 7 or 15, asking those two questions.
Yeah.
What do I know about my kid? What do I know about the digital risks they could be, you know, confronted with, and doing whatever it takes to bring that risk down to a spot where it's acceptable for your situation.
Yeah.
That's what it takes.
Yeah.
After this interview, if you've listened to this point, you'd be silly to not get this book. So all of your information, Protect Young Eyes and where to find you, we'll put all of that in the show notes so people can
awesome.
Just quickly click on all of that.
Yeah.
But I just want to say, as a friend, I'm going to claim myself as a friend.
Absolutely.
I'm really grateful for you. Grateful for your disposition. Grateful for, you have a unique gift to do this work. You're both smart enough and analytical enough to be completely trusted, but you embody grace and truth. And I think when you said you're a CPA, I've never, ever, to this day, ever worked with a CPA that I liked as a human. Now, they're so
that.
Helpful. They keep you out of prison. I'm all about them. I love it. But it's not like we're going to hang.
Let's hang, man. Show me your spreadsheets. Come on, buddy.
Yeah. And there's no, you know, and in our CPA listening, I'm not speaking of you specifically, but
that's right.
I'm saying, other, yeah. But I mean, it's like you embody this idea and I think you're uniquely gifted. It's clear that God has not only equipped you from before you even knew what you were being equipped for to this moment,
yeah.
to step into this moment and to help so many, including us and especially us. And so
awesome.
I know not everyone gets to say this to your face, but thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank
you're
you for
welcome. Thank you.
Confessing and taking that really crazy risk that it felt like risk, but was also just the beginning of the best part of your life to step into vulnerability and honesty and transparency and forgiveness and the messiness that causes. To bless a lot of people, and we're some of the primary ones that you've mm-hmm. blessed, and we're really grateful. So keep up the good work. We mm-hmm. are
you,
all
sir.
In your
yep.
corner, and can't wait for the book to get the book. If you've listened, you will be dumb not to get the book. Like you will be such a miss.
Are you shaming everyone into getting the book?
If there's anything to shame people into, it'd be to get a resource that's going to change your life for the better. Even the nuggets that you left here, I'm like, I can't wait to read this book. So get the book. But check out all things Protect Young Eyes. Chris McKenna, thank you.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.